My name is Kenneth, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And like Pat just said, yes, my sober date is 9-7-54. Well, I'm much older than what I look, believe me. I drank for a period of 8 years. Doesn't seem like much, but believe me when I tell you, I went down the tubes extremely fast. I was almost on the Bowery at the end of 8 years in drinking. I was extremely a shy kid, very shy. I kept to myself most of the time, wouldn't join in, couldn't communicate, and I just lived like that until I found my old buddy, port wine. When I was drinking, port wine cost 35 cents a pint. And I drank a lot of it, believe me. It gave me everything I needed. The courage to talk, courage to dance, courage to drive a car. You name it, it gave me the courage. But everything began to happen to me very fast. I began to have blackouts early on, maybe in my third year of drinking. I was definitely allergic to alcohol. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I went into the military. This began to happen after I came out of the military. It's a strange thing, you know, as shy and as fearful as I was, I signed up for airborne duty. And my first jump out of a plane was, actually I was by myself. I was an extra man on a stick. And the jump master asked me, why not go up with your class tomorrow? I says, no, today I'm going up. And I went up, and I had a good time. And that's strange for a person that was very fearful, afraid, shy, and sitting up here waiting for the last 5 minutes. It was like on jump run. Believe me, you know. Because I do jump now. I do a lot of skydiving. I enjoy it. Because of these rooms, actually. Really, because of the rooms. There's a big difference between sport jumping and military jumping. A big difference, you know. Okay, you're going to backtrack a little bit now with my drinking. I never saw combat, peacetime soldier. All I did was sit on the park bench with a bunch of guys, pass that port bottle of wine, pass that around, and we would just talk about wars we never were in. You know, that went on constantly. Talk about things we never did, you know. Just sit there and drink and talk about, well, things to come that never happened. And that kept on. And I reached a point with my drinking that I said, gee, I have to do something about this. And I said, let me buy a car, an old car, and I could work on it. I was mechanically inclined. And I did just that. But the strange part about it was the car didn't last long. When I bought the car, I didn't have license. I didn't have time to register the car. I didn't have time to do anything to the car, not even wash the windows, really. Fellow bought it by my house. I gave him money, and he shook my hand and says, thank you. I told him thank you, and he said congratulations. I sat on this stoop, and I looked at that car, and I looked at it, and I looked at it. And something said, you know, go buy a bottle of wine and come back and get the car some more. And that's what I did. I drank this wine, a pint of wine, and I called up a friend of mine. He came over to the house, And we began to drink. And then suddenly, I became invisible to everybody. I didn't think anybody would see me, the police or anybody. I said, let me take a cruise around the corner. Now, the car was delivered to me at 6 o'clock in the evening. I didn't have time to have license put on the car. I didn't have the car registered or anything of that sort. I drove it around the car, around the block one time, then two times, and three times, and the third time I heard my friend say, Ken, you're going into a tree. And I went into that tree, and that was the end of the car, 60 minutes after I bought the car. And I am not joking, it was 60 minutes, because my uncle timed it, you know. Okay, that went on for a while. Then I tried marriage, too. Always looking for that crutch, you know, somebody else to help me. And that was a terrible thing to do, because she was a very nice person, a couple years younger than me, and didn't drink, didn't smoke. And it wasn't a very happy occasion. We were together for about a year. And that was it. And I remember trying to make up. After a while, I went to her house. But before I went to her house, of course, I had to fortify myself with wine. I packed up my little bags, my suitcase, and left home, went to the city. And I remember putting my suitcase under the stairwell. And I went up the steps. I don't remember a thing again until the next day. I woke up on the park bench, all cut up and, you know, bleeding. Clothes were all worn and tattered and everything. Shoes were scuffed. And I got scared for the very first time in my drinking. Very afraid. And I had to call back to her house, and her parents said, don't come here anymore. Just like that. Whatever happened there, they got the best of me. I didn't hurt anybody. I couldn't. I was too drunk to do that, I guess. They got the best of me. And from that point on, I said, well, gee, let me see if I can do something about this drinking. And I did. I met a Catholic priest, and I'm not Catholic, and he helped me tremendously. He told me that there was a meeting downstairs at the South Jamaica Group at St. Benedict de Moore's Church in Jamaica, Queens. And I bumped into a Liz B. there. Guess most of you know her? Liz B. She's my sponsor. I met her when she had 2 years of sobriety. That's when I met her. And I had zero. And we became very good friends in the rooms. And a little later on, you know, we used to have these meetings where we would go to one another's house in those days. And we would have our meetings in the kitchen, over coffee. There were restaurant chains, I think it was called Horn and Hoddock's, or then, and a couple of others. And we would meet at these restaurants. And I couldn't wait to go there, to sit there, and we would just talk about AA and drinking, you know. And it was so much fun, you know. I really enjoyed it, and I grew by leaps and bounds just by being around her. Because Liz went through so many different things, but yet she endured. And that gave me the courage to keep on going, too. And I really loved every moment of it. I loved the years that I put in these rooms. It's been a fantastic experience for me to grow. And I can't believe now that I'm standing here in front of all of you talking, because I was a guy that just wouldn't talk to anybody hardly, you know. I would stammer in school. I was a stammerer, you know. I couldn't say a word without stammering, you know. All of that left by means of these rooms. And it was the encouragement that I got from so many members within that group, within the South Jamaica group then, that helped me. There was a priest in there that I used to go around with, and he was in the rooms also, and we would meet together, and I didn't have a car then or anything like that, and we would attend these meetings, you know. And it just gave me so much courage, you know. He died early on, And the way he died, you know, was something I wouldn't want to go through. And it still gave me more courage to keep on. To back up a little, you know, I spent 2 stints in Kings County Hospital on the flight deck, they called it then. And that was a terrible experience. My parents had to take me there. And I was it was such a feeling of remorse and guilt that I carried with me for a very long time. But so many gifts that Bill talked about came to me early on. I got sobered up and I went to my father's house a little later on and my parents, and I asked for forgiveness. Because they were 2 very good parents, my mother and my father. They were great, great people. My father was an example. I never saw him drink, never saw him smoke or anything like that. He put 30 years in the Navy. And it was so strange to him that I should act the way I acted, you know. But I was there for him when they passed, when my mother passed, and when my father passed. I was there for both of them. And it gave me a chance to really to make amends. And I got married again a little later on. And I have 2 wonderful daughters that were born in these rooms. Fortunately, they were born after I came in the rooms. They didn't have to suffer the pangs of me drinking, because they really would have had a hard time. I had to sit down and tell them about my drinking eventually, you know, because I would get calls for, you know, people calling me up, coming to the house and so on and so forth. And I told them, you know, yes, your father was an active alcoholic. And it was a good experience just sitting down, talking and telling them about myself. And both of them have been very well in life, you know. One is a musician. She lives and works in Germany. She's been there for over close to 30 years. The youngest one, I just came from California, and her son graduated from high school and is going to the University of Santa Barbara. And I'm telling you, you know, it's just a fantastic experience that I was able to do all of these things. And if it wasn't for these rooms, it wouldn't have been possible. It wouldn't have been possible. It was a terrible thing to live the way I was living, you know. I had no real need to. I had everything. You know, I had a nice home, you know, and a bed to sleep in and clean clothes to wear and lunch to take to work. But, you know, I don't know. I just wasn't like everybody else. I was different. And I knew I was different. I felt different, you know. And how it came about, I don't know, you know. Because my father was a good father and my mother was a good mother. It was just one of those things. But I think the main thing about it was that I managed to do something about it. And with the help of Liz and so many other people in these rooms, like they say, the old-fashioned way, you know, how we would meet and just hop in cars and go to meetings and things like that and meet in one another's houses and have coffee, just like they did back in the old days. And it was a fantastic experience. Everything good just came out of it, you know. I couldn't hope for anything better. And it just went on and on and on like that. So I consider myself extremely fortunate to be able to live the life I'm living now without those fears, without those doubts, to live sober, to do everything I want to do without having any fears about what's going to happen tomorrow, how am I going to wake up tomorrow, who did I hurt, who did I say something wrong to, you know, have to run back to my friends the next day, and what did I do last night, and they would tell me what I did, and I would say, no, I couldn't have did that, I didn't say that. But then after 2 or 3 people would come and tell me the same thing, then I'd say, gee, it's the truth, you know. I mean, those blackouts were really something else. How I came to have them so early is just one of those things. You know, it happened, and I had to live through it. But I endured the whole thing, and with the help of these rooms, nothing would have been possible. Believe me, nothing would have been possible for me at all. And I went back to school in these rooms. I studied a lifelong desire that I had, that was to be an illustrator. And I got some very good work. I worked in aerospace for 29 years. And I doubt if I lost during that time 10 years of work days. Now, that was not possible when I was drinking. And at the Smithsonian now, you see the limb there. There's a big book that sits at the foot of that limb. I have illustrations in that book. That was the first manned module that went to the moon and back. That was an experience in itself. Just to work on that book. At that time, I didn't think about it too much, but later on I began to say, you know something, Ken? You're making history, just like that. And it did make me feel very good, you know. And it's just enjoyable. Believe me, some of the things that happened to me, I wish I had the time to tell you everything that happened to me since I've been sober in these 60 years. There were so many wonderful things, you know. And those are basically the highlights of my drinking and the things that I did after I came into these rooms. And with that, I want to say thank you very much for being here today. This was a wonderful opportunity just to stand up here and talk to each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
That was fantastic, Ken. Thank you. And I wanted to remind everyone that in history, this day, 80 years ago, was the day that Bill W. and Dr. Bob visited the third alcoholic. 80 years today. So next we have Joanne, who is from Winnipeg, Manitoba, and celebrating 30 years, almost 31. So Joanne, please give her a warm welcome.
Hi, everyone. My name's Joanne, and I'm an alcoholic. It's really fantastic to be here. I was thinking when Ken was talking, how do you wrap up 60 years plus of sobriety in 20 minutes? I think you did a really excellent job, don't you? Yeah. And I'd also like to thank him for still coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my sobriety date is July the 20th, 1984. And, you know, that's not the first time I came into AA. And, you know, the message of this particular meeting is about old-fashioned 12-stepping. And I was thinking prior to coming here today how many times people tried to get me to come to AA. You know, so I started trying to come to you probably, though I didn't know it, in the middle 60s when I was in a mental health hospital because I had a big psychosis. And, you know, I was a teenager then, and nobody really asked me if I even drank. And, you know, that's sort of how the times have changed. And we can fast forward. I got out of that mental health hospital after, you know, being there for over a year. But I have to tell you, the one thing that I learned when I was in that hospital was that they had men alcoholics there. And I met them. And, you know, I remember it. And that in those days, they had what they called was an aversion treatment. And they gave you a drink of alcohol, and you were supposed to get it like an electric shock when you got this little, and it was supposed to send a message to your brain saying, "Oh, alcohol is bad." But I have to tell you that when I met every one of those men, they all told me how they found a way to get that drink down, and the shock wasn't that bad anyway. So I have to tell you that when I first, you know, heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was sort of my attitude as well. And, you know, I always want to say that, you know, the I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984 to stay, to become a member of AA. I can say today that I'm a member in good standing of AA. I come from the St. Vitale group in Winnipeg. I've been going to that group since 1979, and that I think that I'm a member in good standing. And by that I say I attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, before I go on, I just want to, you know, I have so many friends in this room, not only the ones that I haven't met yet, but I have friends here that have known me for so long, and I'm so grateful that you're here. Thank you. Thank you. Because there's so many other things they could be doing while in Atlanta. And they've taken the time to come and hear me. And you know, you find that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You find those friendships and those people that care about us. And so I'm thank you to all my friends, and you know who you are. Thank you. I also, you know, one of the things that I like to say when I sober up is because it was to relieve myself of, you know, the fear and the whatever it is when you're standing in front of people. And I used to, you know, I heard a woman say this a long time ago, and I actually got to meet her in Minneapolis at a Women in AA conference, and it was in Minneapolis here. It was one of the big meetings, and she introduced herself this way, and I asked her after if I could have it. Because you know what it's like, once you hear something in AA and you use it three times, it becomes yours. So this is what she said, and she made me laugh so hard because I totally could relate to it, and my friends know this about me. You know, my story is what it was like, what happened, and what I was wearing. or not. So the other thing, I just want to welcome everyone here. So I'm not going to tell you a lot about 1979 when I came into AA and how I was 12-stepped in. I really actually ended up in another hospital in Winnipeg, where I come from. And I'd been in every hospital in Winnipeg, you know, in their emergency unit at one time or another. And then I talk about the friends of AA, the people that, you know, have been giving them information about Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's the first time that I got 12-stepped was really for myself, was actually from a member, you know, a psychologist from the St. Boniface Hospital. He actually asked me a few questions. He says, you know, you seem to come here a lot. I mean, I knew my medical number off by heart. You know, I'd just be reciting it, and they'd throw me in a corner and forget about me because they were sick and tired of me. But this one time, this man took me aside, and he started asking me some questions. And he said, you know, everything that he asked me, you know, the common denominator was, well, when that I was drinking. Whatever happened then, I was drinking. And he was the one that suggested to me that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I'll give you the number. Here's a schedule. And that's the very first time that I actually heard from a lady from the St. Vitale group in Winnipeg. She called me, and I met her at a meeting. And that was my first sort of 12-step call. I mean, it was not the kind that, you know, in the old days, you know, you think about it. I heard it this morning in a meeting when they said, you know, really, you know, when Bill went to Akron, and when Bill, you know, was desperate, it's in a vision for you. He talks about, you know, that he's in bad shape, so he needs to find another alcoholic, right? And it wasn't to save the other alcoholic, really. In the beginning, it was to save himself. So what happens? He meets Dr. Bob, and of course, on June the 10th, 1935, is Dr. Bob's dry date. And, you know, they were in a parking lot, and he fed Dr. Bob a beer because he had to do surgery. He was shaking. And, you know, you think about what happened since that day. And I heard that this morning in a meeting, and it really resonated with me that I thought, isn't that just the darn truth? And that's why we're sitting here. That's what happened. And Bill and Bob got together, and here we are, and all these things that happened since. So I was, you know, in 1979, I met that lady. I went to the St. Vitale group, and I met some really good people. They really tried to talk to me. A woman sat down with me at one of my first meetings, and she said, you know, these are the things that you have to do, because I had so many problems. I mean, you didn't have my life. You didn't have my mother. You know, you didn't have, you know, all those things that were wrong with me, so I didn't hear. But, you know, I have to say that when I think back now, they all said the right things to me. How many times have any of you actually gone to somebody's home? I've gone to people's homes and talked to them. And I've been in several situations, and I've seen some things happen in AA that shouldn't happen in 12-step calls. You know, that people go there, and then they don't leave for 3 days. You know, that's why it's really important that maybe a man and a woman go. Or, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, that's the truth. You know, we have to have the visual here of what is the truth and what's not the truth. Because I've seen both sides of that coin. And, you know, I find it very amazing that those things happen, but they do. And, you know, we never want to talk about any of that, but that's just the darn truth. So I was in and out from 1979 to 1984, and I have many little chips to prove it. I got a couple of one-year medallions, you know, because I did stay sober in between, but I never really did the steps. I never changed. I never did anything. My problems were still great. And I thought that if I, you know, if I could get over those problems, you know, on my own. In 1984, I had actually changed my job in 1979 because I thought if I left that particular job that it was because if I wouldn't drink so much. And then I got another job and it had a bar that was even closer, but I know that that's what happened to me. So in 1984, when I did come back, you know, it was really amazing. I came back through a detox. I'd never been in a detox before. Imagine that. Every time prior to this that I ended up in a hospital, my first stop would be the psych ward. And the other amazing part about that is today that I don't have any medication that I'm on. I think of all the things that I put in my body over the years, and that I can still say today, all I had today so far was some glucosamine because I'm very old and arthritic. But that's about it. And, you know, it's amazing. So in 1984, I was in the detox, and a man came up to me and said, you have some choices here. Would you like to go to River House, which is a women's treatment center in Winnipeg? Would I like to go to St. Rose? Would I like to go to all these things? And there was a voice in my head that said, Joanne, go back to the St. Vital group. Just the AA is there. And I know I need it. And I went back to my group. And it's really amazing when that happened because, you know, I went back to the group and all of a sudden I had two ears attached to my head. I was actually listening. And all those same things that people were saying to me all those 5 years previously, I started to hear. My daughter, when I came in 1984, I was this close to losing my daughter to my own family because they said I can't look after her anymore. I couldn't be trusted with my own child. And I was devastated. I mean, we all have a place. There's that place in your pit. It doesn't have to be a number, a name, or whatever, but there's that place. And if you're sober here in this room, and when you first came here, you know what I'm talking about. It's that utter feeling of hopelessness, that utter feeling that no one can understand how you feel, and yet somebody finally seems to understand you. It's totally amazing. And so here I was, at the St. Vital group, and my daughter, I have my daughter, and I'm trying to be a good parent. I'm going to work. I'm going to meetings. I go through aftercare. I do all the right things. And one of my friends says, you know, there's a beginner meeting in another group, and it's very close to us. I mean, I'm so fortunate. I live in a community where there's all kinds of AA groups. And so I go to this other group at 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And I listened. It's a square. There's women all around a table like this. And I heard a woman speak down from me. I didn't have the nerve to sort of go like this to see who she was. But I heard her voice. And I went back the next week because, do you know that person that you heard that raised the hair in the back of your neck? That one? Well, she was that one. And I got the nerve to talk to her the next week. And she had said to me, this saved my life, by the way. She said to me, well, I have an opening on Tuesday nights at my house. And if you come on Tuesday nights, we'll go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous today, together. And when we did that, I mean, that was the biggest 12-step thing anybody did for me. But I tell you right now that my mind was thinking, you know, I'm kind of busy on Tuesday. You know, can't we have it on, like, Thursday? You know, when I'm available? And, you know, really and truly, she said, Joanne, she almost, like, knew what I was thinking. And she says, Joanne, that's the only night I have available. And so I went every Tuesday night. And I learned about, you know, being a woman, you know, being a woman in the world, being a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and being able to stand and look at the ground in my feet and know that I was solid and sober. She helped me do that. You know, today that woman's 43 years sober, and, you know, she's 86 years old, and, you know, she has some dementia today. And, you know, I can still see that woman that saved my life because we all have somebody in our lives that we give them that, and we shouldn't put them there. But I put her there for that reason, and she always said to me, don't put me on a pedestal because I'm really going to piss you off sometimes. And she did. And she did. But I'll never forget her. And I hope you all have someone like that in your life that help you. And I hope that what she taught me that I can give to another person, another woman, another member of AA. And so, you know, that's what's happened to me. And so by staying sober, you know, I had really great opportunities in sobriety. You know, as I stayed sober, I flew into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got involved, and I thought that, you know, I'm so glad now that my sponsor taught me that I had to get into the middle. I had to be grateful. In order to be grateful, I had to be useful. I mean, how do you think my group stays well? We need people in the group to do jobs. And I started doing that, and I got really involved in service. And, you know, congratulations on being the delegate for Area 59. I think I served with a woman named Nancy Kay. And, you know, I remember serving with her well. We served on the same committee. And, you know, those are the friendships and the things that you remember from all those years away. And, you know, after that, that was in 2002, 2003. And up until that point, I'd been through the steps a million times. You know, and the other thing that I learned how to do was be different in my life. I became clean with all those things. And my first 12-step person taught me how to do that. You know, she taught me how to do all those things. So I learned how to do, you know, talk to people when they came in. Because we think about today, you know, I came from the land of the treatment center. You know, but prior to that, you know, people went into people's homes. People sacrificed everything. And you think about, you know, I've been to Dr. Bob's home. Has anyone been here? Been to Dr. Bob's home? And do you know some of the stories that they write about? You know how some woman or some man chased Anne around the kitchen with a knife? You ever been in their kitchen? You couldn't swing a cat in that kitchen. You know, so you think about, wow. I mean, the things and the lengths that people went to save another person's life. How many people here have lost people? You know, you've 12-stepped them. They learn about AA, and they don't make it, and they die. You know, there's that too. There's all those things. But as I stayed sober, I thought if I ever saved every obituary that I have from people that have died that I've known through Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, my big book, I'd have to get a whole thing to it. It's amazing. So sitting in this room today, we're sober. We have a chance today. And if you're sitting here today suffering and in trouble, please talk to somebody. Please don't let the day go by without talking to somebody. Don't let that get so big in your head you can't. You can't. I've been there. Have you been there? I know that. And so as I stayed sober and as I got more involved in AA, you know, some fantastic things had happened. In 2007, I got elected to be the trustee at large for Canada. And if you know anything about that service, that job, it was, I got to serve on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, what an amazing honor, and I could not believe it when it happened. And as a matter of fact, you know, the person who presented my resume at the General Service Conference is in this room today, and I'm so grateful to him for that, you know, that he was actually the person that did it. And I swear to God, he must have really talked well about me. So thank you, John, for that. And I think that, you know, after that happened, this was about old-fashioned 12-stepping. So, you know, the other thing that comes to my mind when I think of that is, you know, not only do we 12-step each other as people, you know, new countries, as they're coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, they 12-step each other. You know, I've been to countries where the Bill and Bob of those countries, they're still alive. I've met the founders of AA in different countries. You know, my very first trip as trustee at large was I went to Mongolia. Can you imagine that? Going to Mongolia and, you know, flying from my home in Winnipeg, flying, you know, to Los Angeles and then flying to Korea and then flying to Ulaanbaatar. And then a whole bunch of little Mongolian alcoholics picked me up at the airport. It was fantastic. And, you know, they took me to my hotel and, you know, they want to know about AA. They want to know about AA. They want to know how to 12-step, and they wanted to form a structure so they could do that. And, you know, in all of Mongolia at that time, I think there was like 20 groups, and 25 people came to this meeting in Mongolia. And, you know, it was in one of those, they call it a yurt. And in Mongolia, they call them ger's, G-E-R. And I remember having this meeting. And they were talking about the alcoholic. How can we reach the alcoholics in Mongolia? How do we 12-step these people? And, you know, Mongolia at that time, they were being 12-stepped by Japan. Japan was their sponsor. Japan was teaching them about Alcoholics Anonymous. And their big book had only been translated in 2003. It was totally amazing. And, you know, are you that excited about AA? I remember being in that room and the chairperson of the board was speaking. And they had little clipboards and pieces of paper and a pencil. And he said, you know, this is a very exciting weekend. We're here to change AA and bring AA full force into Mongolia so that we can carry that message, you know, to that person in the Gobi Desert. It was just, it was so amazing. And I've never seen this in my own group for a very long time. That when he talked about, with that excitement and that enthusiasm, I swear to God, everyone in that room leaned forward with their pencil on that board, ready to make a change. Have you ever felt like that? When was the last time you felt like that about Alcoholics Anonymous? They were so excited. And you know, I'm going to finish off with a story because I know I only have 20 minutes, and my husband says I can talk 20 minutes to a wrong number. So, sorry. And he's not here to start going. In 2008, I had the privilege, and you know, I could tell you a million stories, but I thought I was thinking of the two that would be the best for this. I attended Lithuania in 2008, and they were celebrating 20 years of AA in 2008. You know, so you know that, you know, they're not very old. As a matter of fact, there'll be a Lithuanian flag being carried here tonight, I'm sure, so watch for it. Watch for it. There was a Mongolian flag carried in 2005, the very first one in 2005. And Lithuania, the very first flag was carried in 1990. But the story I wanted to finish off with was this. When I went there in 2008 with the celebration, I met Romas, who was the founder of AA in Lithuania, and I listened to his story. And I might be a little bit wrong on some of the things, because I think I'll never forget everything, but I'll tell you the gist. That Romas was an alcoholic, and he was trying to get sober. He didn't know what was wrong with him. And he went to a doctor, and the doctor said, you know, I can't help you. But he says, you know, I have a bunch of names of these Lithuanian-speaking Americans, and you should phone them. And, you know, Romas, being a really good alcoholic, he said, oh, I want help right now. And he put those phone numbers in his back pocket, and he left. And he, you know, he wandered around for another couple of years. He was a writer, and he wandered around, and he was still drunk. He would try to stop on his own, but he couldn't. And then one time he was walking around, and he walked into a church. And I can tell you, I've been in the city where that was. It was Vilnius, I think, in Lithuania. And he walked into a church. And in Lithuania, there's a church on every corner in that city that I was at. I mean, but he walked into this particular church, and he sat down. And he was very distraught because he thought, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't sober up. And he talked to the priest, came and spoke to him. And then the priest went away. And Roma said, where's he going? Like, I haven't finished talking, you know, sort of thing. But the priest came back and he handed him a book written in Lithuanian. And what had happened was a man had come to that church a few years earlier and asked him to translate that book into that language. And he didn't come back. But that book was written for Romas because he was there that day. He gave him that book. And in the meantime, I mean, that just gives me a God shake. And I know that, you know, Romas had called. He'd finally called that number in the United States. And the next month, 12 men came from California speaking Lithuania, and they helped Roma start AA in Lithuania. And that was in 1988. Isn't that a wonderful story? And how that is? So I just want to tell you that, you know, I have many stories like that, and God has really given me a gift and a vision of AA. You know, there's a million stories, you know, that I could go on and on about, but I want to leave you with those, and I really want to thank you for my life and my sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Fantastic. And next, from Mrs. Aga. Did I say it right? Mrs. Aga? Canada. We have Eric. And please help me welcome Eric.
Okay. I'm an alcoholic from Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, which is a suburb of Toronto, if you need to know. I'm a member of the Markland Wood Group there. Meets on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. And so if you're in that neighborhood, drop in. Just not all of you at one time. We may have a little problem with seating. So I want to thank the committee for asking me to come here and share my experience with old-fashioned 12-stepping, which I've had a little experience with it. My dry date is July the 30th, 1972, and for that I'm incredibly pleased that Alcoholics Anonymous was able to do that for me, even though I didn't want it when I came here. I wasn't that bad, you know, and even though I had drank for 20 years then and drank everything I could get a hold of, I was not one of these discerning drinkers. Whatever there was the most of was good for me, and sometimes that was some pretty rank stuff, but it got the job done, and it didn't quite kill me, so I guess it was all right. I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous through an intervention of a doctor that I had seen many times, and he put me in touch with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and even though I didn't want to talk to that guy and I didn't want to go to AA and I thought that I was going to be able to figure this thing out on my own, which I'd been trying to do for a long time, and it hadn't happened, but I was getting close to it. I was sure of that. But anyway, I allowed that guy to give me a call, and it was an honor for him, I'm sure. So anyway, he called me and he asked me if I thought I had a problem with alcohol, and I said I'm not sure. Now I was just coming off of a 10-day drunk, and I was shaking all over and sweating and kind of like what it is today here for me, but racked with the dry heaves and from not eating for all that period of time and being in a blackout most of it and all this, all the good stuff that happens when you're an alcoholic such as I am. And I'm telling this guy that I'm not sure that I have a problem with alcohol. And he wasn't buying it because he said to me, he said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been sober nearly 5 years. And he started to tell me about what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him and all these great things. And I was not interested in it at all. And he said to me, would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm thinking, like, I don't think I want to go there. I don't think they have much to offer me. And I said, yes. Which will tell you that I'm not here by any of my smarts. It's by the grace of God, I can tell you that. And consequently, I ended up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next night. And I had no intentions of staying here. I knew that, being as smart as I am, that probably two or three meetings, and I would have this figured out, and I would be able to take all the answers to this to my drinking buddies, and they would be just delighted with it. And it didn't work out that way, thankfully. I met some wonderful people at that first meeting. I have no idea who spoke. I don't know what they said or anything. It doesn't matter. It makes no difference. Like I contend that most of the time, 15 minutes after I'm finished speaking, nobody remembers what I said anyway, and it doesn't matter anyway. So, but anyway, this I met this man that had called me, and he sat me down and told me what it was like for him and what had happened and what it was like then, and in a very short, condensed way. I was amazed. I was simply amazed. This guy was from, I'm from the east coast of Canada, and I used to say that was plenty qualification enough to be an alcoholic anyway, because I believed that everybody that I drank with there drank the same as I did. This is a disease of perception, and it turns out that my perception was not very good, because most of them didn't drink like I did. But anyway, he was from the same part of the country I'm from. He was working at the same place I was supposed to be working at then. Notice I said supposed. And his drinking story was very, very similar to mine. And again, he's telling me about he's been sober for almost 5 years, and I don't care because I'm not going to be around anyway, and I'm not interested in 5 years of sobriety. But what happened was that after the meeting, a number of people came over to me and shook my hand and welcomed me and told me to be sure and keep coming back. And I was quite taken by that because I got to tell you, it's been a long time since anybody told me that they were glad to see me anywhere and even at home, and they certainly wasn't asking me to come back. And some of them asked me for my phone number, and I gave it to them. And from giving my phone number to these people, it ensured that I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous whether I wanted to or not. And that's what happened. These people 12-stepped me on a daily basis for a long time. And we would go to meetings far out of Toronto on a weeknight. And in those days, there was no curfew on sobriety, I can assure you of that. Like the meetings went on until the meetings were over. And we had speakers that would go on for an hour and 45 minutes. And after the meeting, there would be another meeting. And then on the way home, we would stop for coffee. And then when they'd get to my place, they would want to talk for a little while longer. And at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting out of the car, and I'm thinking that they're trying to kill me. And because I had to get up at 5:30 in the morning and go to work then. And as it turned out, these people were not trying to kill me. They were saving my life by their actions. And I am sure, looking back on it now, that these people, some of them, had other things that they could have been doing on those nights. They could have been spending a little time with their family, maybe, and putting in some time there. But they took the time to look after this alcoholic. And so I stayed sober, and in spite of myself. And I found a power greater than myself that is easy for me to call God. I don't have no problem with that. And that concept is evolved over the years. It's something that's there constantly. And I don't know whether I understand it or not, but I do understand that when I ask for help, that power is there. And that's pretty much good enough for me. It seemed to work fairly well. As I got sober, even when I was only a few months sober, these people started taking me on 12-step calls. I had no idea what I was doing. And I just went along because they told me that I should go along. And whatever they told me to do, I did, because I didn't have any better ideas then. So we would go to a lot of 12-step calls, because in those days there were very, very few treatment centers. There were detoxes, but the detoxes were full anyway. And most hospitals that would take an alcoholic were full, and they didn't want any more. They were not our best customers. So anyway, I would go on these 12-step calls, and these guys would talk to these alcoholics, and some of them were in desperate shape, and they didn't all get sober, let me tell you that. There are many of them that died later on. One of the guys I used to go with used to take a Mickey of either rye or rum with him. And that sounds strange, doesn't it, to be taking alcohol with you on a 12-step call. But it was because of some of these people were so far gone that they were going into alcoholic convulsions. And the only way to keep them from going into that was to give them an ounce or two of alcohol so that they would steady down enough that we can get them either to a meeting or into a detox or into a hospital, hopefully, and maybe somebody could save them. And that went on for years, and then I started going into jails and places like that and carrying the message in those into jails. And it's a very transient group of people, and you never know what happens to these people. Like, you hope that they're going to get sober, but there's no telling what's going to happen. And for years, I went into the different jails around Toronto, and I think there was maybe twice that I attended one-year anniversaries for people that actually got sober and stayed sober. And outside of that, the others, I had very little idea of what happened to them until one time I was at a friend of mine. It was his 25-year medallion, and he'd asked me to read something for it, and I was there. And after the meeting, a gentleman came over to me, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Not really." I said, "You look familiar, but I really don't remember you." And he said, "Well, you and another guy, his name, Guy Hal, used to come into the West Metro Detention Center and speak to us about Alcoholics Anonymous. That was 15 years ago." And he said, "I'm going to get a one-year medallion next week." And, you know, I look at that and I think, you know, it was all worthwhile if there was one. And that's the way we used to do it in those days. And I did that for quite a long time. It's not that I'm a great guy or anything like that, but it was for what I was getting out of it. Early when I used to go on these 12-step calls with these guys when I'm in my early sobriety, I said to them, like, "Why are we doing this? They're not getting sober." And the one guy, well, it was actually my sponsor, said to me, he said, "They may not be getting sober, but we're staying sober, aren't we?" Then I kind of got the idea what it was about. It really wasn't about me at all. You know, I'm just an instrument of my higher power to carry a message to the still suffering alcoholic. And it's if they want to take that message and use it and to their benefit, they're welcome to do it. But if they want to reject it, that's a choice that's theirs as well. And lots of them have rejected that message over the years. And I have certainly attended far, far too many funerals for people that actually did come to Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober and stayed sober for a number of years and decided that they had a better idea and their idea ended their life. And that happens. That happens. It's an amazing program, though. I've seen people, the group that I belong to now, there was a young lady came to that group a number of years just before I joined it. And she came out, she was a street person, had a little baby. And she was living on the streets in Toronto and sleeping in stairwells and wherever in the parks and wherever and doing whatever she had to do to support that child and her habit. And she came to that meeting, and a guy was there that was hardly anybody that would talk to him. Rob knew the guy, Bill P., that was just a maniac and very, very crusty and belligerent, but he was sober. And he got a hold of Lisa, that was her name, and he told her that she had to do something about her education and to help herself. And he just hounded her about it. And so she went back to school. And a few years ago, she graduated as a lawyer. And she has her own firm now. And that little boy that she brought to the first meeting that was just an infant is now, I think, 13 or 14 years old and well-adjusted. And she's married and has a happy family life. And, you know, you look at some of these people like Bill that was, like, people avoided. I know I avoided him for a long time because he was a tough customer to deal with. But under that crust of toughness was a gentle, kind soul that he didn't want anybody to know that he was like that, though. And his 12-step work didn't only benefit this Lisa, but many, many other people. And, you know, God can do with us what we can't do for ourselves. And even though Bill put on this front, God was working through him and providing help for many, many suffering alcoholics. And, you know, I don't easily forget people like that. You know, they say if you meet somebody in AA and you don't like them, you should sit beside them, get to know them. You might find a different person there. And that's been my experience, that some of these people that want to be so tough aren't really tough at all. They're kind, helpful people that can be used by God to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so over the years, a lot of wonderful, wonderful things have happened to me. I've been able to attend meetings in other parts of the world, and it's interesting to go to places where Alcoholics Anonymous is relatively new, and we don't have they don't have the benefits of what we have here, but they still stay sober. They make do with what they have, and I maintain that we're the luckiest people in the world to be here. If we're here at Alcoholics Anonymous, like, we got nothing to complain about, I can tell you that. We may find things to complain about. I know I do. But it's not legitimate. And so wherever I go, if I go anywhere, so I always look up Alcoholics Anonymous. And some places you go there, and you may have to ask a number of people before you find it. But if you're persistent enough, most of the time you can find it. You know, I spent some time in Cuba a number of years ago, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous was relatively new there then, and I had to ask about six different people before I finally found out where there was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it turned out it was right across the street from where I was staying. Pretty ironic, really, isn't it? And from that, I found out where some of the other meetings were, and they're held in, you know, private homes, and they move from time because they can't afford to rent halls or anything, but it's still there, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous is quite vibrant there, and these people are getting sober and staying sober the same way we are. You know, people are telling them what happened to them and how they got sober, and so they're putting that to work in their lives, and they're doing the same thing. And like it was mentioned about Lithuania and all these other places, where Mongolia, like, my God, like, we're so fortunate to be where we are, and I want to thank you very much for the time you've given me and my sobriety. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Pat, and I am an alcoholic. When I was newly sober, there's some people in the room that may remember that they used to call me Liz, because everyone in AA had a nickname. So mine was Liz. And now, believe it or not, it's Mrs. Claus. Because of staying sober, I have become Mrs. Claus in the Thanksgiving Day Parade in Philadelphia. And I got that because there was a Mrs. Claus in the parade and she got drunk. So they asked me to do it. But, you know, they told me that the more I give, the more I would get. And that's always been the case in AA. And I was sitting there remembering a story that I had a girlfriend who lived in Palm Beach. She lived in Jupiter, Florida. And she was really in a bad way. And so I was going to go down to Florida and do some 12-step work. And I didn't know if it was a good thing to do, because the old-timers always told me that never go alone. Always take someone with you, because you may try to pull them in this program, but they might pull you out in the process. So I took the plane, and I was walking through the West Palm Airport, and I was praying, I actually kept saying, I said, you know, Lord, I said, if this is the right thing to do, you know, please be with me. And I know I'm not supposed to, and I'm going through in my head. Well, with that, as I walked through this ramp in the airport, a coin rolls up the floor, and it comes up and hits me in the foot. And it's an AA coin. And a young guy comes running up after the coin. And I said, do you have a number on that coin? He said, yeah, how do you know? I said, I have one too. And we had a little AA meeting right there in the airport. And I knew, you know, as was mentioned before, so many times, I know I can't get somebody sober, but we can be used as a channel. And recently I had an opportunity to do a 12-step call, and my higher power has such a sense of humor to remind me that I can't get anyone sober. I was on a plane going to see the Phillies for the spring training, and I sat down next to a man, and we got speaking and talking, and he told me his sister had this terrible problem with alcohol, and she was, you know, older. And I said, well, you know, I'll give you my number. I might know some people that could help her. Never thinking I'd hear from him. But when I came home to Philadelphia, he called. And he said, my sister really needs some help. He said, I'm really worried about her. So I called and took a woman with me from my home group. And so we went to see this woman. And her son went and got us pizza. And we were talking and doing our best 12-step work that we could do, going on. And she really wasn't paying attention to us, and we knew we weren't getting too much, you know. And when we left, she said, well, you know, if I need you, I'll call you. We said, okay, all right. We didn't push it. We knew that it was attraction, not promotion. And so then I never heard from her, and so time lapsed, and I knocked on her door. It was a while, and no one answered, and I got worried. I thought, oh, wow, you know, maybe she passed. Because he said she was really bad. So then I called the brother, and I said, I just wondered how your sister was. And he said, guess what? And here we are thinking we did so much, right? He said, my sister got Alzheimer's or dementia. And he said, she forgot she was alcoholic, and she stopped drinking. So we had no effect at all. Another time I was at a meeting, this place called Up for Grabs used to have a beginner's meeting on Thursday nights, and I chaired the meeting, okay? So going back a little bit, and you know how sometimes newcomers will share at the very end, they'll put their hand up last. Well, this young fellow put his hand up, and he said, my name is Naish, and I had never heard that name before. He said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, and he spoke, And you know, after the meeting was over, the next day I was in work, and I had to call information, telephone information. This is back, you know, 411. And so the guy answers the phone, and he says, Naish here. I thought, what are the chances of that, right? And I never do this. I don't usually blow my anonymity unless I think I can help someone. And so after I did my business, I said, Naish. I said, were you at a church last night at Castor and St. Vincent? And he got dead silent. And he said, yes. And I said, do you remember the lady in the front of the room at the desk? He said, yes. I said, that was me. I said, how are you feeling today? Well, dead silence again. And he said, okay. I think he thought the AA police found him. He said, I'm really happy that you came with us last night. I said, please come back next week. We would love to see you. He said, okay. He did come back the next week. He said, I went in the men's room and got on my knees and said, Our Father. I went in and prayed too, because I said, Lord, you know, this is how it works. You use us as instruments, and isn't it great? And yesterday, one of the men from Spring Spring Hill, Florida, came up to me, and he said, you're a delegate. He said, I have a button for you. He said, I want you to wear this. This is the AA police. So I have a badge for the AA police. And I am so grateful that you are all here today. And Eric told me he was going to leave me time. Thank you, Eric, and thank you all. Let's give them another round of applause. It's amazing the situations that our higher power puts us in and the people that they put in our lives. And I hope that if there's anyone here that's new, that has never had an opportunity to do any kind of 12-step work, the old-timers used to tell me that just speaking at a meeting, just sharing at a meeting was a way to practice the 12th step. And I totally, totally encouraged that, because there was a time when I couldn't open up at all and I would just cry. But they taught me to talk about how I felt. And and I stand here today so grateful, with a grateful heart. Pardon me. I remember a particular 12-step call we went on, again, at Up for Grabs. And a guy came up to me. And in those days, it was mostly men. It weren't too many women. And someone came to the meeting for me to say that they had a girl that was passed out at home and she had a baby. Would I come to the house? So I tried to get another woman to come with me, and I couldn't. But then there was this fellow, John, who was a detective. I said, would you go with me? And he said, sure. So we went to the house, and she was passed out on the couch, and the baby was sitting on the floor, and there was a German Shepherd standing over the baby. To this day, I don't know if that dog was protecting that baby or was ready to go for the baby. And so we found someone to take the baby. And we talked her into going to Frankfurt Detox. And we sat with her. We sat with her for 5 hours. And again, we talked and talked and talked just about, you know, ourselves and our own situation. And we had her almost there. She was ready to stay. And a nurse came out, and this, they don't always end well, all of our stories. And the nurse came out, and she said, honey, she said, you can't stay here all night. She said, this isn't the Salvation Army. She said, you're going to have to come back at 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, with that, the girl got up, and she ran out the door, and she ran down Frankfurt Avenue, which was a busy, busy street. It wasn't in the best area. And I said, John, what are we going to do? And she jumped in a car. And I thought, oh, no. Because she said to the woman, she said, if I get home, I'm going to get beat. She said, I can't go home. And then she took off. And I was heartbroken. I said, John, this is horrible. He said, Pat, there's nothing we can do about it, you know. And I just prayed. I prayed so hard for that girl, because I didn't know what could happen to her in the situation she was. And about 5 years after that, I was sitting at a meeting in a place, and I felt a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and it was her. And she was in a meeting, and she said, I apologize to you. She said, I didn't treat you too well that night. I said, I am so happy to see you. It does not matter at all. So, you know, we never know how these things are going to turn out. But as was said before, if we spread the seed, if we plant the seed, that's all we can do. And let our higher power do the rest. So, let's see, I think we have a couple minutes. And would anyone like to put their hand up and share? I wanted to tell you that coming from Pennsylvania, I brought some pickles with me. And I know most of you know the little tradition about the pickles, which was before we started the drink, we were cucumbers. And once we crossed over that imaginary line and we became alcoholics, we became pickles. And once you're a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber. So at the end of the meeting, I'll be glad to give all my pickles away. And they're from Pennsylvania. So they're from the delegate from Pennsylvania. So please remember that once you're a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber. So I thank you so much.